I'm Holly Raffel from Ohio University's Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Affairs, and I'd like to first just announce that I have no conflicts of interest as well to disclose. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge our friends at HRSA for kindly providing the support for us to do this study. And I would also be remiss if I didn't acknowledge my research team as well. And along with my co-authors, we have a lot of sort of on the ground, boots on the ground researchers at the Voinovich School, at our Scripps Survey Research Center, as well as the Appalachian Rural Health Institute at Ohio University. We were asked at the beginning when we submitted our presentations to have some learning objectives. And so I have three of them, and they're on the handout that I gave you. So hopefully you'll hold me to those and make sure that when you walk out of here, you felt that you've met your CE requirement. The first was to describe the importance of a regional assessment of disease prevalence. The second was to identify at least two key predictors of diabetes self-management in the Appalachian region. And the third was to describe strategies for increasing diabetes self-management in the Appalachian region. What we did is we had a research question. We wanted to know what factors predict diabetes self-management in Ohio's Appalachian region after controlling for age, gender, educational attainment, and insurance status. You know, we hear a lot that my patients aren't checking their blood glucose once a day because they can't afford test strips, they can't afford this, they can't do that. And so we said, you know, we have this data, so let's take a look at it and see what exactly predicts checking your blood glucose once a day. What we wanted to do was investigate factors that contribute, of course, to diabetes self-management, but we also wanted to look at it from a regional lens. So the first, your learning objective number one, describe the importance of regional assessment. And I don't think I need to do that in this room because you're probably here because you understand what being rural is. I live and was raised in Ohio's Appalachian region. This map shows the United States Appalachian region. It's a 205,000 square mile region, and it follows the spine of the Appalachian Mountains. West Virginia is currently our only state where the entire state is encapsulated by Appalachia, but includes parts of 12 other states. We know that 42% of this region is considered rural, compared with 20% of our national population. So then let's take a step back and look at where I live and work and was raised. I was raised in Claremont County, which is right here, and I work in Athens County, which is right there. What we have been doing is looking at our 32-county region. When we started this initial study, there was 29. They added three, which is the top three towards Lake Erie, Ashtabula, Trumbull, and Mahoning, sort of in the middle of our study. The 32 Appalachian counties are designated as Appalachian by U.S. Congress and the Appalachian Regional Development Act of 1965. And that looks at not only your location, but it also looks at the economic development and opportunity. And being Appalachian status allows you some more ways to build the capacity within your state. So where do I look at? For this particular study, we had nine counties. We had Belmont, Columbiana, Gallia, Harrison, Jefferson, Lawrence, Monroe, Muskingum, and Noble County. And what's interesting is that why we do this research is that when we look at the BRFIS data, our BRFIS data is around our metropolitan areas. So that's our Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati. We call them our three C's in our state. And we feel that our Appalachian population a lot of times gets underrepresented in our counts. We've been doing this. This is our third wave of data collection. The national BRFIS diabetes rate in the state of Ohio is 8.6%. The Ohio BRFIS rate is 9.5%. In our nine Appalachian counties, is 12.5%. Okay, we see that we get missed largely because of the sampling schemes that are necessary for the BRFIS, and we understand that, but we want to be able to be sure that we give our population a voice. In our counties, our nine counties this round, we had diabetes prevalence rates as low as 8.8% and as high as 16.0%. And we realize that we're still missing a lot of people because we know that in Appalachia, we have a lot of people who don't have phones, and this was a phone survey. So I think we could, in fact, be underestimating as well. So I think it's important to look at any health issue, not just diabetes, from a regional lens because it can sort of unwrap the layers and tell you what's exactly going on within your region. I think right now it might take a few minutes to step back and contextualize our project. This project is the third in the series of projects examining the health status of Ohio's Appalachian. The first survey was conducted in 2003. We did four counties. And then the second was conducted in 2006. So in all, we have 20 of our 32 counties represented. This round, we have a research report that we have. We also have four short reports. And I brought extra copies of these if you're interested. We have one that focuses on diabetes, one that focuses on disease prevalence, one on health access, and one on factors that affect health status. Our report and our sort of our impetus for doing this research is they're used by local health departments in their planning phases. A lot of our federally qualified health centers use these in their five-year grant cycles to help them do planning as well. A lot of folks use these to secure funding. We've changed our reports over time, and I have the web address on the handout, and you can access those. Our constituents said, you know, what we'd really like to do is see a lot of comparisons related to Healthy People 2010. And so in this final round, or our third round, you'll see in the report that we've done a lot of comparisons to those indicators that we've set for ourselves in the United States. So how do we do this? Well, it's a phone survey. We survey 3,481 adults. We use the same questions as the 2007 BRFIS, including the BRFIS diabetes module, so that allows us some direct comparisons. The survey was also conducted between November 2008 and February 2009, so you have an idea of the time frame. We had a 10% response rate, a 20% cooperation rate, and a 37% refusal rate. We strive for a stratified sample using gender and age, and we attempted it, and of course we didn't achieve our goals, particularly in our younger cells, so we had to post-stratify. Now the question that you're probably all thinking is, why didn't I stratify by race or ethnicity? And the answer is because over 95% of our study region is Caucasian, and so there was no need to do that. Our analysis for this particular part was limited to the individuals reporting that they were told by a professional that they had diabetes. And similar to the BRFIS, we excluded all of our females who had gestational diabetes only for our analysis. So we had some variables that we looked at. Our outcome variable was monitoring blood glucose levels at least once daily. This is well used as an indicator in the literature. So basically, they had to check their blood at least one time a day for glucose. We had some covariates as well. And so I kind of divided them up. The first are demographic characteristics. And again, you can see the unweighted and also the weighted proportion here. We looked at gender, male, female. We looked at age. And we divided our age into three categories, again, based upon the literature and how other folks had looked at diabetes, because we wanted to be consistent as we were sort of putting all of our work together and where it fit with everyone else's. We looked at insurance status, we looked at annual household income, and we divided that up in quartiles just to make sure we had some variance in there. We also looked at educational attainment, high school or less, or at least some college. We looked at health and lifestyle characteristics. The first was self-reported health status, and we characterized people who said their health was fair or poor versus those who said it was good, very good, or excellent. Like the last study, we also looked at comorbidity. Comorbidity mean that the person had diabetes plus one or more of the following: asthma, arthritis, heart attack, heart disease, stroke, high blood pressure, or high cholesterol. And as you can see in our diabetic population, most people had at least one comorbidity. The distribution that you just get what you get when you do a phone survey, and I think there was not a lot that we could do to preserve the variance on that. One interesting factor that we also looked at was self-reported depressed mood. We asked people, how often did you feel so depressed that nothing is going to cheer you up? And we split those up into all or most of the time, and some a little or none of the time. And we had a psychologist on our research team who sort of helped us with that measure. The moderate exercise and vigorous exercise are framed in terms of Healthy People 2010. So for moderate exercise, you had to exercise at least, or had to say you exercise at least 20 minutes a day, five times a week. And vigorous is 20 minutes a day, three times a week. And again, like the previous study, we're all not exercising near enough. And then we looked at our smoking status, current smokers versus former smokers versus those who had never smoked. The other covariates we had were our diabetes care characteristics. The first one was, is have you attended or been a part of any type of diabetes self-management education? And it's about 50-50 in Ohio. And that's likely because Ohio is one of four states that don't have that do not have a mandate or insurance requirement related to diabetes care. So there's no mandate saying that they have to reimburse for diabetes self-management education. We also looked at cost restrictions on diabetes care. So we had three questions. We had, are you not able to pay for test strips? Are you not able to pay for doctor visits? Or are you not able to pay for medications? And if they answered yes to any of one of those questions, then they were put into the category that yes, they had some restrictions on diabetes care. Of course, we use descriptive statistics and correlations to investigate the relationships between blood glucose monitoring and all of our covariates. We used a multivariate logistic regression model. We actually modeled with a backward stepwise procedure, and we assessed our model using the adjusted wall test, and we basically based our work on the work of Hosmer and Lee Michelle. So this brings us to learning objective number two, identify at least two key predictors of successful diabetes self-management in Appalachia. And what we found is that we had three, prior attendance of a diabetes self-management education class, self-reported health status also impacted, and self-reported depressed mood. You'll notice that we left a lot of non-significant predictors in the model, and you can see that on your handout as well, but we wanted to control for age, gender, education, and insurance status. So those who attended a diabetes self-management education class were 80% more likely to monitor their blood glucose at least once a day. So what we found is that even exclusive of whether or not they can afford test strips or afford their medication, I mean, that actually followed the model very early, is that actually having that class linked to, wow, this is important, so I need to make sure that I'm checking my blood glucose. So education does have an impact. With self-reported health status, we found that those who actually said they had better, they were feeling very good about their health, were less likely to check their blood for blood glucose at least once a day. And we think that's because this is the Ohio's Appalachian region, and people like to use qualitative measures to assess their health more so than quantitative, or they like the subjective better than the objective. I'm feeling pretty good today, therefore I don't need to check my blood because I know how I feel because I'm the best judge of that. And so I think that's important also when we think of how we frame our education. And then we also found that self-reported depressed mood also had an impact, and individuals with higher depressed mood were more likely to check their blood glucose daily. And when we looked at that population, we had to sort of separate that out and tease that out, and we found that that population was women who were reporting depression who also had very high BMIs, and so were in that obese category as well. So we have some implications, which brings us to learning objective number three, which is describe some strategies for successful managing of diabetes in Appalachia. And first, our findings suggest that an individual's financial situation does not impede successful diabetes self-management. We found that diabetes self-management education is one of the best consistent predictors. And I think that shows that if people feel that it's important, they're taught that it's important, they understand why they're doing it and why it's important in impacting their health, then they'll make sure that they can do that. With respect to service delivery, chronic disease management is largely overseen by primary care physicians, and that's very true in rural areas. So we feel that it's very important to train the primary care physicians to provide that diabetes self-management education, because oftentimes it's the physician, particularly in rural areas, who's that frontline person who's doing the diabetes education. With respect to good self-reported health status, again, it has a negative relationship with diabetes self-management behaviors. So when you're designing those education programs, it's important to place emphasis on the fact that, yes, you may feel good, but you don't know how low or how high your sugar is unless you're checking it. Okay? So you need to have that objective measure. So I think that's important to be packaged up with any education program. The diabetes self-management or diabetes checking, managing your diabetes in relationship to diabetes. We had a very large confidence interval with that. So I really would interpret that with caution. That's why I said you're going to learn at least two, is because I'd rather you take home the fact that good supportive health status is negatively associated with diabetes management, and diabetes self-management education is a really important factor. It's a huge confidence interval. I think we need a better structured measure of self-reported depressed mood. I mean, we gave them one question. We didn't give them a series of questions or things like that. So how do we know these people are depressed? I think it's something to think about. We do have part of our research team that does focus on diabetes and depression, and they have found significant relationships, but with this data, I don't think it's strong enough. Like everybody who does survey research, we have limitations, the first being that we're unable to distinguish between type 1 or type 2, and of course that, with our outcome measure being monitoring your blood glucose with type 2 diabetes, there hasn't been an established measure of how often those folks should do that. But what we find, like most survey researchers, is that when you ask people if they have diabetes type 1 or type 2, they don't know. It's important to us as researchers, but to the individual, they know that they have diabetes. And you'd be surprised in my database, a lot of the database I work in, how many men who said they had gestational diabetes. So I think that it goes to show you that it's really difficult to tease out the type 1 and type 2. Again, as common in survey data, our distribution of variables are less than ideal because we're not controlling the situation. We're simply doing a phone survey, and our comorbidity is an indication of that. 92.8% of the people living with diabetes in our survey had some type of comorbidity, and only 12% were at a healthy weight. So I think we have that, that working against us in there. We also lack a comparative urban sample, which limits the extent that we can make direct comparisons to rural-urban disparities. But again, this just shines a light on that we need to focus on Appalachia. So to summarize, you had three learning objectives. The one was to describe the importance of a regional assessment, and I think we covered that regional patterns can shine the light on disparities. We need to hear from everyone. We need to get everyone an equal voice, not just those who live in our large MSAs. Identify at least two key predictors. We have diabetes self-management education is strongly associated with it, with our outcome variable, and perceived health status is negatively associated. So we need to think about how we are educating people. And then we have depression, which we're going to kind of sit and watch and watch the research unfold on that one as well. So describe strategies for increasing. One, diabetes self-management education is important and it's valuable and it helps ensure that people are doing what they need to do to manage their diabetes. Two, in rural areas in particular, if PCPs are going to be the primary deliverer, we need to make sure that they have the education that they need in order to deliver that education to their patients. And three, we need to focus on more objective measures, at least with our population in rural Ohio, rather than just how I feel, more subjective. Thank you. Yes.
In Appalachia, would you have a problem in doing phone surveys in terms of a certain amount of the population not having phones?
Yes, we do, and we know that that's a limitation that we have. We do the best that we can with what we can and see that. And I think what you see is we have a large older population in our sample. We also have, and consequently, you also have a population that's covered by Medicaid. Typically, people who are older tend to answer and are more affluent tend to answer the phone when you do phone surveys. And so that's something that's inherent in that. So we recognize that as a limitation.
How did you
Those are people who actually start the survey, and then somewhere midstream they just stop. So the refusal rate means I've started, and the survey was about 20 to 25 minutes long, and sometimes people, particularly what we know about the culture of Appalachia, is letting outsiders call and come in, and I'm not going to divulge this information. So at some point during that survey, those folks said, this is too much for me, and so they stopped. So refusal is not the people who hang up, and those are the people who actually start, and then at some point, so we have partial data on those people, and I think it's just it's sort of intuitive that any survey we do with Appalachian, we have that refusal rate because people start and they're okay, and then you've asked me way too many personal questions, so I'm not going to answer. And you had a question as well? BRFIS doesn't have very good coverage of the Appalachian region at all, so that wouldn't be a good comparison. It's been fairly consistent through all three of our surveys. So I think we have a lot of hesitation in Appalachia for people to share, and I think we do it, and they say we're from Ohio University, so the people in our contiguous counties, we have no problem with them, but the further we get from our epicenter of where they recognize us, and they haven't heard of us, there's not that established trust. We lose that as well. Yes? Health status. That was kind of our warm-up question, and it was just how do you perceive your health status? Good, very good, excellent, poor. Just a very general subjective. And so I think that's what leads us to think that they're using that same subjective, this is how I feel, with their diabetes self-management.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.